ॐ भरताय प्रतिबोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्धतामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वैषिणी.
So verse 27. I read this just at the tail end of the class last week. So we'll go through it a little bit more this week.
Jatasya hi trivo mrityuh. Jatasya hi trivo mrityuh. Dhruvam janma mrtasya cha. Dhruvam janma mrtasya cha. Dhruvam janma mrtasya cha. Tasmat aparihara yarate. Tasmat aparihara yarate. Natvam sochitum arahasi. Natvam sochitum arahasi. Jatasya hi dhruvaha mrityuhu. Dhruvam janma mrtasya cha. Tasmat apariharye arte shochitum arhasi.
This whole last few verses and this verse also are talking about the reality of what we call vyavahara, this empirical creation that we experience. There are certain realities, and one of the realities is that people who are living die. That is a fact. And it's a fact that we're not going to alter. You may be able to extend your life, but living beings die. And so here, Krishna is just pointing that out to Arjuna, that because remember at the very beginning in verse 11, where Krishna really begins teaching Arjuna, the whole message that he starts with, you know, is that you are grieving for that which does not deserve grief. Right? You're grieving for that which does not deserve grief. And at the same time, you're speaking the words of the wise, because he's really eloquently talking about Dharma and about the problem. You know, that this is a irreconcilable problem, and he's very, very eloquent. And what he says is true, partially. So he's speaking the words of the wise, and at the same time finds himself in this predicament of grieving for what does not deserve to be grieved. And so now, in all of these verses, not working very well. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Sorry, online people. I know that the volume is not that good, but it's about as good as it's going to get, because we've already been working on a lot. So. So Krishna is approaching this problem from every conceivable standpoint. And he's now going to be wrapping up one standpoint only to start another one. Right? Because this is the problem. We're grieving for what does not deserve grief. That is the basic problem. And of course, if we're going to say something like that, you're grieving for that which does not deserve grief, we might as well pick, you know, the most profound example that's available in samsara, and show that even this, which obviously does deserve to be grieved for, but even this, that obviously does deserve grief from the standpoint of just one's normal vyavahara, one's normal relationships, let's look at that and show how that doesn't deserve grief. But these type of examples, and Swamiji will always joke, it's like, you know, in these heavyweight fights with he'll talk about Muhammad Ali, okay? If you were to knock out Muhammad Ali, then everybody else is knocked out. That's his example, right? If you can knock out him, then everybody else you might as well have knocked out. Or what some of these other guys, these big brutes that you know, are the champion. If you can knock out the champion, right, then everybody else is as well knocked out. And so really here, in terms of a situation that would cause grief, this is an exalted situation. And so that's why Krishna is looking at it from all different angles to show that even this situation, this most extreme situation, does not warrant grief, does not deserve to be grieved for. So here in this verse, he's giving just a simple logic. He says, for something that has been born, jatasya, for that which has been born, he means here because or indeed, jatasya hi dhruvaha, it is certain, it is for sure, dhruvaha, what mrityuhu, that there will be death. Something, for something that's going to be, that's been born, dhruvaha, definitely, mrityuhu, death is there. And then he says, dhruvam janma mrityasya cha, and for something that has died, definitely there is birth. So which that, I spoke to this a little bit last week. It's so understood in India and in the East, this transmigration of the soul. You're born and you die, and you're born and you die. That is samsara. When they talk really about liberation from samsara, it's liberation from the cycle of endless birth and death. And we can look at that endless birth and death even in terms of one individual life, because an individual, within an individual life, there is endless birth and death in the terms of change of experience. That is the birth and death of every given experience that you have. But they look at it even, they extend that. It's not just the birth and death, the change, that we are bound by change in this life itself, right? We're bound by change in terms of the death of this body and then the rebirth of another body, death and rebirth. So the whole cycle of rebirth is being discussed here. So he says, definitely for a being, jata, somebody that's come into being, there will be death. And for somebody who has died, there will be birth. This is what it is. There's nothing you can do about this. This is the nature of creation, that what is born will die and what has died will be born. Okay, so that's exactly what he says. Then he says, tasmat, therefore, apariharye arte, toward this thing, toward something, which is inevitable. Nothing can be done about it. It's apariharye, you can't change it. It's inevitable, it's the nature of the creation. When that's the case, toward something like that, na tvam shochitum arhasi, you are not qualified to grieve for that. It does not make sense. That's what they mean by qualified. It does not make sense for you to grieve over something which is inevitable. And so when there's a case like that, when there is something inevitable like birth and death, and you're grieving over it, you really have to look inside and look at what are the attitudes that are ruling you. Because if you're going to be grieving over things that nothing can be done about at all, this is an impossible situation. So basically, what he's saying, you have to accept the facts as they are. If a fact, and Swamiji talks a lot about this too, just in terms of karma yoga, you know, a fact, if it can be changed, right? And it's in the best interest of yourself and others to work on changing that, then you should work on changing it. There's nothing wrong in that. There's a situation, and there's some way that you can improve that situation. Then you would naturally want to improve the situation. And so you would make efforts to do that, right? And that's appropriate. What wouldn't be appropriate in terms of karma yoga is if you make efforts to improve the situation, and the situation does not improve in the way that you had expected, for then for you to be to go into mourning over that. Because what's the problem with something like that, even here in a situation where you can change the situation, if you think that you are the, what would we say, omnipotent. In other words, if you believe that you are the center of the world, you know, so that the way that you want it to be is the way that it must be. There are just too many factors. There's too many factors in any given situation for you to be able to control all of the elements. And so that's why the whole karma yoga that's taught in the Bhagavad Gita, the basic attitude is this: I following my desire, you know, act in the situation to fulfill the desire, whatever it may be, as long as it's in my best interest and your best interest. It's not a dharma. It's not an adharma. I act to fulfill that desire, and I accept the results as prasad from the Lord. Because that attitude is sane. That's the sane attitude. Because I don't have control over all of the different factors involved, you know, that are involved in my fulfilling a given desire. So I do what I can, and I accept the results as prasad from Bhagavan. And then I try again, if I really want to. Yeah? And I accept those as prasad. And then I try again, and I accept those as prasad. Everybody know what prasad means? It means if you go to the temple in India, or here to a Hindu temple, and you go, and the pujari, the priest, is doing the ritual to the Lord, offering, doing various chants and rituals and whatnot, offering flowers and so many things. At the end of that worship, we take back from those offerings, the pujari takes back from the Lord those offerings, and it could be flowers or flower petals or food, or some just sandalwood, or it could be even just be some water. You'll take that back, those offerings from the Lord, and offer it then to all of the devotees. So the priest will come out and give what's called, this is called prasad. It's the blessing, it's the offering from the Lord back to you. Right? And so the pujari will come and give it to you, and you'll hold out your hands like this, and maybe it'll be some flowers, just some and some sandal paste, or just some water. And the water, you know, you'll never throw it out or drop it on the ground. Even the water, you might put it on your hair, put it on your forehead. Sandal paste you'd put on your, you know, on your forehead. The flowers are usually put behind their ear. You know? And sometimes what it'll be is a whole banana leaf full of food. It could be a whole meal that's being offered. You know? But whatever the offering is, the devotee receives that as a gift from the Lord, as a blessing, you know. And so when we say that prasada buddhi, that's the buddhi. You're in dialogue, in a sense. You're in relationship with Bhagavan. You do an action and you get back the result. If you have that prasada buddhi, then the result that you get back, like say, Swamiji will joke, say the devotee went to a particular temple where usually they give a whole banana leaf as the prasad, a whole meal. That's usually the prasad. Or it could be a whole meal with a ledu. Ledu is a big, big sweet, you know. And so the devotee went there, you know, and it was time for the prasad. And all they were giving this time was just a few little flowers, you know. And so can you imagine the devotee receiving the flowers and going, I don't want the flowers, where's my meal? Now, in India, that's inconceivable. You know, it's inconceivable. You know, that buddhi means that way of thinking, you know, that way of thinking would not occur. Even for the one who went while hoping they'd get a meal, that buddhi wouldn't occur. So one day when Swamiji was telling this story very elaborately, you know, Paul, one of our friends, was sitting there in the the class, and he kind of laughed and he said, "Well, what's wrong with that?" Everybody cracked up. Everybody cracked up, and all of the whole Indian community laughed. They all know him. Maybe he was kidding, but the idea is that type of buddhi is not possible. It would not occur in reference to prasad, for a devotee. So like that, say in reference to those things which you can change, right? You take actions to change, but then you accept the results as Ishwara, prasadam. Prasad, that's what we call prasada buddhi. But now here, Krishna is talking about, okay, these things, these things you can't change. And it's also, kind of in the Indian culture, it's also understood that a person takes this life, comes into this life with certain karma. And those karmas, so this verse is, all of this is tied in this verse, that's what I'm saying. Those karmas will take you all the way through to your death. And there are a whole series of experiences that you will go through. In a general way, you have free will to kind of maneuver within those experiences. But there's the unfoldment of your life that takes place. And when those karmas are over, your life, that's it. This particular life now has been exhausted, right? And so then you will die. So you'll take this birth, live your life, and then you will die. And then you'll take another birth. And you'll live your life, and then you will die. And it goes on like this, endlessly, really until a person gets knowledge. And so this is something that's absolutely understood. And so when this is the case, when this is inevitable, what is it that you're grieving for, exactly? Okay. And, there are things, like he could say, well, I want to be with them a little while longer. I want to be with... I know that they're going to die. I'm not an idiot. I know they're going to die. Right? I want to be with them longer. Right? So all of these type of feelings. So he's going to go through the whole gamut. Even if you say...
what kind of animal is that?
If you're all reading the Gita Bhasha on this, it's a nice little story in there. Say you even that, if you say, I just want them to be here for a little bit longer. I don't want to have to face this now. I don't want to have to face all of this death now. Okay. He says, even then, you don't know. You have no idea. You could walk out the door and drop dead. Right? It's a fact. Nobody knows when their time is going to be. And you think, now you think you know because there's going to be, this war and you're going to be killing everybody. They're all going to be killed. But in fact, you could all die before the war even starts. Right? So nobody knows their time of death or the time of death of their family or their loved ones. In fact, if you were to know, say you knew, for instance, that all of us are for certain, or you, at least you for certain, you are going to live for another 7 days. This is his story that he talks about. You are going to live for 7 days, no matter what. Then he says, you're better off than everybody else. At least you know you're going to live for 7 days. Nobody else knows that. Right? So you can just freely do what you want for the next 7 days. You know you have that amount of time. None of us know that, right? We could actually drop dead at any time. But so that's a reality. So, It's a good reason to kind of live consciously now and enjoy the life that you have, because actually it could be over in a minute. It could be over right now, in fact. We don't know. Very interesting. I noticed it once. It's kind of... So many of us have these kind of shocking experiences. Once, a few years ago, I was just, you know, driving along in the city, and all of a sudden I was in an accident. I wasn't really hurt. But what I'm saying is, I was just driving along. There was nothing going on. And then,
yeah.
You know?
Suddenly.
And then suddenly, suddenly there was an accident, you know? Just like that. That's how it is. Suddenly, somebody drops dead. For anybody that has lost a parent, all of a sudden you get the phone call. You get that phone call, you know, that your parent has had a stroke, or your parent has something has happened. Now all of a sudden they're on their deathbed. That's what happens, right? And then everything changes. Everybody has to go into a whole different mode of operation, just like that, because they're going along fine until that happens. It's the same for you. You're going along fine until something happens. And then when that something happens, that is a moment. That's a moment of change. You know? And so death is like that too. So what if we spend our life grieving about, it's again a projection. You know, we're grieving about what is definitely going to happen. And so here the point is, Arjuna is grieving about all of the people that are going to die, right? And they all are going to die, but we don't know when they're going to die, and we don't know who's going to die. And you yourself might die before any of them do. So that's the point. So he says, when there is something inevitable like this, it doesn't deserve grief. In fact, this is an area where you need to have some vairagya. Vairagya really is... sometimes it's viewed as, you know, kind of dispassion, don't want anything. It isn't really that. It's coming to terms with the way things are, with the reality, with not asking the world to give you or to be in a way that it isn't. You know, when you ask the world to be in a way that it isn't, you're causing an incredible amount of grief for yourself, you know. And so, in fact, the more you understand, which is which Vedanta is so profound in this way, it's so clear in trying to make you understand the way things are. Sometimes when things are pointed out, then you understand it almost as a no-brainer, yes, this is the way things are. It is a fact, for instance, that everybody dies. Everybody is born, everybody dies. That is a fact. It is a fact that we don't know when we're going to die. That's a fact, you know. It is a fact that every object of desire, everything in our life that we've desired, that desire may or may not be fulfilled. That's a fact. And it is also a fact that most of the things that we have desired and fulfilled, we no longer desire. Right? In other words, desires come and go. And the objects of desire come and go also. You can have a desire, fulfill the desire, get tired of the object of desire, and move on. And that's basically how it is. Every single object of desire is something that also comes and goes. Your desires your desires themselves come and go. And also, the desires conflict with each other. You know? So there's no rhyme or reason to them. That's the idea. So when that's the case, when the desires themselves come and go, and all of the objects of desire come and go, is it reasonable? If that's the fact, and that's the experience, it's an experiential fact. It's not just a philosophical theory. It's actually a fact of life. And when that's a fact of life, does it make sense to ask those desires and those objects of desire to give us something lasting? A lasting sense of well-being. Does that make sense? I would say once you start thinking about it, it's ridiculous. If your sense of well-being or wholeness or fullness is in any way really dependent upon the fulfillment of these desires, you're asking the creation to be something that it's not. You're asking your mind to be something that it's not, because that would mean that, say there were any truth in that, if you could just fulfill this particular desire, you would then, everything would be fine from then on. Then you have to ask yourself, do you think that you would be able to continue desiring that? Say you fulfill a desire, and now everything is fine because you fulfilled the desire. Now the challenge is for you to continue to desire it. You know, it doesn't usually work that way. So anyway, the idea is here in reference to birth and death, it's inevitable. And so the relationship we have to have with it has to change. It has to change to match reality, right? To match the reality. So here, let's go to the next verse because he says more about it.
Avyaktadini bhutani, vyaktamadhyani bharata, vyaktamadhyani bharata, avyakta nidanam yeva, avyakta nidanam yeva, tatraka paridevana. He expands on this. Avyakta adini bhutani, vyakta madhyani bharata, avyakta nitanani eva, tatra ka paridevana. He says, in the beginning, Adini, Bhutani, all beings, all creatures, in the beginning, are avyakta. Avyakta means they're unmanifest. So before, let's look at it this way, it's very simple. Before a child is born, before an infant is born, you know, it's unmanifest. It's not here. It's existent, but it is unmanifest. It's avyakta. So in the beginning, all beings are unmanifest. You don't know where they are. They're somewhere, but they're not here. So that's what avyakta means. Then it says, so in the beginning, they're unmanifest. Then vyakta madhyani. Then in the middle, they're manifest. Here we are, manifest. Manifest simply means that I can see you. You're manifest. You're here. You're available for sense perception. So in the beginning, a creature, a being, is not available. They're avyakta. Okay, then they're born. They're here. They're avyakta. Now we experience them. And then what? Avyakta nidanani. Then, after death, they disappear. They become avyakta. They're not manifest anymore. They're not here. So being is here. First it's not here. Then it's here. Then it's not here. Right? He says, that being the case, right, when that's the reality, what is there to be to grieve about this? What ka says, ka paridevana tatra, regarding this, what is the sorrow? Why are you grieving regarding this? That beings come into manifestation and go out of, are they here, and then they go out of manifestation. They appear and they disappear, appear and disappear. What is the source of grief here for this particular reality? This is the way the creation is. This is the way the creation is. There's nothing to grieve. Okay. Let's do the next verse.
Ascharyavat pashyati kaschitenam. Ascharyavat pashyati kaschitenam. Ascharyavat varati tathaiva chanyaha. Ascharyavat vadati tathaiva chanyaha. Ascharyavat jainam anyashranoti. Ascharyavat jainam anyashranoti. Shrutvapyenam vedanaschaiva kaschit. Shrutvapyenam vedanaschaiva kaschit. Ascharyavat pashyati kaschit enam ascharyavat vadati tatha eva cha anyaha. Ascharyavat cha enam anyaha shrunoti. Shrutva api enam veda nacha eva kaschit.
This is a famous verse. It occurs in another, I think, the Katha Upanishad also, I think it is. Something similar. There's two ways of reading this verse. Ascharyavat. That vat affix means like, right? Ascharyavat, like a wonder. Something that's ascharya means it's a wonder. You experience it and you're just in awe. So it gives a sense of awe, a sense of wonder. So here, ascharyavat pashyati kaschit. Kaschit means the one who, someone, a person, anyone, a person, someone. Pashyati, someone, kaschit, pashyati sees enam, enam atmanam. A person, some person sees, one person, a person, sees the self. This is the first way of looking at it. He sees the enam atmanam. One person sees the self as a wonder. As it's seen, the person is in awe. It's a wonder. Then, ascharyavat enam. Ascharyavat vadati tatha eva cha anyaha. Another person, similarly, another, anyaha, he vadati, vad means to speak. He talks about the self, teaches the self as a wonder. As the self is being unfolded, the teacher itself, the one who's speaking of it, speaks of it as ascharyavat, as a wonder. Ascharyavat cha enam anyaha shrinoti. Then another person who's hearing it, right, who's hearing about it, pashyati, hears it as a wonder. Okay? To hear all the, in this interpretation, the Atma is what is the wonder, right? So somebody sees it, they see it as a wonder. Somebody teaches it as a wonder. Somebody who hears that self as a wonder. Then, Shrutva api enam veda nacha eva kaschit. Says, and then somebody else, even though having heard about it, heard it, doesn't know it. Shrutva, having heard, that twa affix, shrutva, having heard, inclinable past participle, api, shrutva api, even though having heard, enam, this atma, enam atmanam, Vedana does not know cha eva kaschit. That cha means and. And indeed, someone, a person, even though having heard it, Naveda doesn't know. Okay. So, here, when you think about it, looking at the Atma as being the wonder, when you do see it, when you do hear about it, when it is being taught and the student is understanding it and you are seeing it, it is a wonder. I mean, especially when a person is initially, if you just remember also, if not at the present, remember what it was like to first start recognizing, or as you first start to really understand, when you first start to really to see, what are you seeing? Is that this myself, the self that I am, is the whole. That the self that I am, this me, this Atma, is not subject to death, is not subject to birth and death, is not subject to change. And not only that, It is this very self that is the self of the whole creation, is the, both the subject and the object. So that recognition that remember, when you come to this knowledge, you come to this knowledge as a jiva. What that means is, you are you, but because of self-ignorance, you take yourself, the you that you are, the I, the Atma, you take yourself to be this body, mind, sense organ subject to death. Because the body is subject to death, the mind is subject to change and the sukha, dukkha, to sorrow. All of these experiences that I have, none of them are lasting. That's my experience as a human being. Right? And so I come to this teaching with the experience and that I'm a finite person subject to sorrow, right? And subject to moments of happiness. Sukha dukkha, sukha dukkha. That's what I come to this teaching with. With a felt sense inside that there is something more. Because, see, you have to remember also, all of the religions in the world acknowledge something more, right? Even they will acknowledge like a heaven and a hell in Christianity or Judaism, heaven, purgatory, hell, that you go to. Right? So that's saying right there, all right, there is something more for you that survives this body, you know. The idea of lasting happiness in heaven, or lasting burning in hell. There is an idea of the possibility of attaining lasting happiness, you know. So we have all of this in the back of our mind anyway. And then if you've studied all of the other religions in the world, they're all doing the same thing. There are hell worlds, there are other worlds, there are other lokas, there's the transmigration of the soul. All of these things. And my own felt sense of not being able to conceive of my own non-being. You can imagine it, but the one who's imagining it still is. See what I mean? If you can imagine your death, but there you are imagining your death. And so you can never have any type of experience of non-being, or imagine it really, because your being will always fill the imagination. And then, at the same time, in all of the religions of the world, everybody's exposed to the idea that I would go on, you know, but I don't know that. I don't know it. I want it to be so, but I don't know it. And what I do know for sure is that everybody dies. And I know for sure that I experience happiness and sorrow, not just happiness. That's my experience in my logic. So that is firm. It is firm that I am a limited being. Because as long as I'm this body and mind and sense organs, I'm a limited being, and I know that. So I have what we call nishta, you know, nishta, jnana nishta, in the nature of this creation and the finitude of myself. And so then, when I am exposed to this teaching and that unfoldment takes place and I start seeing, you know, that in fact it isn't that way, that in fact the body is not just the subject, it's the object. That there's a subject. That there's a subject that objectifies the body. There's a subject that objectifies the sense organs, that objectifies the mind. That there's a subject to all of these things, that itself is not objectified. When I start realizing that me, the self, right, this self, this innermost subject is not something objectifiable like the body and the mind and the sense organs. I start seeing that and I start then understanding, you know, the relationship of my being to all of this, and I start recognizing the changelessness of my being. That's a wonder. When I start recognizing that I am all of this, what could be more of a wonder than that? To recognize that I am the whole. So the person who sees I am the whole, that vision is a wonder. I remember feeling this also when I was in India, when I was first studying with Swamiji in Rishikesh, and I was understanding. My mind was totally blown away. And part of the wonder was that this knowledge even exists. Mm-hmm. It's just a wonder that this knowledge exists, and this pramana is taking place, and you're seeing step by step by stepping. You're understanding that you are the whole. But the very fact that there is somebody teaching it, so there's somebody teaching it there, that you are the whole, and you are there listening to it, that itself is a wonder. So I would sit in class listening to this, Swamiji would be teaching it, I would be hearing it, and the fact that that existed, that there was teaching and there was learning, that this existed, to me was an incredible wonder, let alone then the seeing of what that knowledge was unfolding. So the whole thing was a wonder. And then, for somebody who knows, as one becomes at home in this knowledge and gets it, then it becomes also a wonder that this knowledge, having been taught, a person cannot get it. That is also possible. And even though having heard, someone can hear it and then not get it. That is also possible. And that is a wonder. It's a wonder because, it is, yeah. It's a wonder because the knowledge is talking about you, and it is very obvious as it becomes seen, as is any knowledge really, you know, knowledge can seem so complex until it's understood, and then it's very, very simple, right? When you see something, then it's very simple, it's very natural. And here, what you're seeing, what you're recognizing is right here. It's you. And also, the teaching itself that's pointing it out is pointing out something that is in fact obvious. The obvious is being pointed out. That's part of the problem. Swamiji will often joke, that's the problem. The obvious is being pointed out, and the obvious is too obvious. It's too simple. Knowledge, self-knowledge is very simple. Words like self-realization and enlightenment are not simple words. When you say that, just think about it. That person's enlightened. That person's a jivanmukta. It means living, liberated. That person is a jivanmukta. They're enlightened. They have self-knowledge. You know, there's nothing more that you can have. It's the pinnacle. You know what? All of it's true. There is nothing more. There is nothing more to be gained than self-knowledge. It is the pinnacle. It is the completion. And so therefore, it must be extremely difficult.
Right? Not right? For
so, me. It's the pinnacle. You know? The farthest you can go.
Yeah.
Then, of course,
the Super Bowl.
It must be very hard, only to be achieved by a few. Now, you know what? It is only achieved by a few. Therefore, so look at the logic. It is only achieved by a few. Therefore, it must be very difficult. Because when we say in the world, we say something is only achieved by a few, like only a few people become movie stars. Only a few people become the best in a given sport, the best tennis player, or the best musician, or the best, right? There's only room for very few people. And those people have to have skill beyond skill. Right? They have to be exalted in their capacity. And most of us could never dream, you know, to get near them in their level of perfection. And so that's how we think, you know, about somebody who becomes exalted in a given field. And true, none of us probably can get there, right? You're probably not going to be the best musician, probably not going to be the best tennis player, not that somebody can be, you know, if you bring that with you, you know. But then when we think of enlightenment, that's so far beyond being a good tennis player. Right? So the level of expertise and the level of whatever must be extreme. Because it's a big word, enlightenment. It must be extremely difficult. And the fact is, it's not in that ball game. It's not in it. And the word enlightenment or self-realization in reality doesn't exist within a context like becoming the best musician or the best tennis player. It doesn't exist within that context. What is unusual about it? Why very, very few people even come into the sphere of wanting it, you know, is because you kind of have to go against what is natural to your experience. What is natural to your experience is you are an individual and here is the world and you have to make your way. That's what's natural to your experience. And I need this and I need that to be happy. That's how we go through the life. The whole creation supports that. Some few people say, what is going on here really? What is really going on here? Who am I really? Most people don't have time for that question. I have too much to do. What do you mean, who am I? I am the one right here, you know, trying to get my work done, trying to bring in my paycheck, you know, trying to do 100 different tasks that need to be done. This is who I am and this is what I'm doing. What are you talking about? Really? What are you talking about? No, I really want to know. What's the purpose of all of this? Oh, God. What have I given birth to? You know? That's rare. That question is considered rare. But that question doesn't mean that you have to become the greatest musician. You know what I mean? That question is rare. Very few people ask the question. Very few people are mumukshus. It's true. It's considered a great punya to ask those questions, for them to even arise. It's considered to be a great blessing, a great punya. That in the Abhiveka Chudamani it says, you know, you could have must have gone through crores and crores of lifetimes of punya to come to take a birth where you have a mind that is interested in this, wanting to know who you are or who God is really or what is really going on. That's considered a tremendous blessing. But and so that's a wonderful thing, and all of the Upanishads will praise the students and say, you know, that you have this question is a tremendous grace, is a tremendous blessing, that itself is a wonder. Very few people have that. And so the students are praised for that, you know. But now, that doesn't mean that this is hard. It means that once you have that question and you want to know, that doesn't mean that the answer is hard. See what I mean? That you happen to have the question is unusual. But since you have the question, it doesn't mean that now that you have the question, you know, you have to become a great tennis player. A great, you know, a great enlightened one. That this is some huge task. That we think this way is a problem. Because it keeps knowledge away from us. You know, and it isn't true. In fact, the knowledge itself is extremely simple. It is extremely simple and extremely obvious. But we have to unwind, and it's part of the job of the teacher is to unwind the students from all of the conceptions. the misconceptions, you know, that make knowledge so distant from us. In fact, another way of saying it is to need to get rid of all the misconceptions that make myself so distant from me. You know? It seems ridiculous, but it isn't ridiculous. I mean, there's a lot of baggage around this. Myself, this me that I take to be myself now, you know, is Brahman, not some other self. The self that I experience as me now is Brahman, is infinite. So the experienced self is already here. This one thing is the most difficult for you to recognize, that the self, you, that is already present. Now, if I could even say like this, in Aparokshanubhuti in Shankara's text, near the end of it, he talks like this. The self that you are, it already is in Nirvikalpa Samadhi. You're already in Nirvikalpa Samadhi. Forget about it. Now, what would he mean by that? You know, because Nirvikalpa Samadhi, usually when we talk about that, what it means is that I'm making my mind very subtle and very quiet so that it's not competing with my own being at all. So just the conscious being that I am is now illumining a mind that has no other activity other than just being a pure mirror to myself, right? So that it just, everything becomes invisible, and then I, just as me, just as the subject, I alone am present. Because for you to have any experience of duality, you require your mind, right? Let me explain. For me to see you all in this room right now, I require my mind using my sense organs. So I have my eyes are open and I'm using my mind, so now I'm experiencing this duality. What if my mind is daydreaming? My sense organs are open, but I'm experiencing the daydream. Okay? So I experience whatever my mind is doing. Now say, I do japa and meditative techniques and whatnot, and I make my mind completely quiet. No activity. There's no daydream. There's no thought flow. There's just silence. So now I'm illumining silence. Right? But that silence is still, there's duality. I'm illumining silence. But now what if instead of having the mind just be focusing on silence, what if the focus of the mind is on its own content? What if the pot focuses on the clay? What if the mind focuses on its own being, on its own conscious being, which is the very self, the very being of the mind? What if it focuses on that? Then there's no silence. You know, there's no glass mirror there. There's nothing like that. There's just solely the content, the being. That's all. That's Nirvikalpa Samadhi. So usually that's how we think about this word, Nirvikalpa Samadhi. But now, the fact is that yourself, this me that is present, is always nirvikalpa. When is it not nirvikalpa? Nirvikalpa means without duality. When does the self have parts? You know? When does it ever change its condition? When does it modify in any way? In fact, your being is always, always nirvikalpa. It's always exactly the same. Does the perceptions that you have cut through your being? No. Does your being, who you are, lose its nirvikalpa-ness when your eyes are open? Does this look like this? Do you see how with your eyes are open and you're looking and out at the room, do you notice how everything that we're perceiving is pervaded by space? Right? Everything that we see, the space is pervasive to it. Right? If you walk around, you're not cutting through the space. Space pervades it. That's our experience as we look at the room. So now we can say, is the space divided? Is space being divided or broken in any way by the beings that are occupying the space? Is anything happening to it? You say no. The space is more subtle. Everything moves through it. It's fine. No problem. It's not being hurt in any way. In fact, if I threw some ink up through the space or some filled the room with smoke, would space become smoky? No. But smoke would exist in space. Right? So that's our experience of the creation. Now if we think like this, is this room with the space in my awareness? Yes or no? You can't very well say no. Can you? You can't say no, because if you said no, then you wouldn't be aware of it. So obviously the entire room is in your awareness. All the movement, all of the activity, the room is in your awareness, the room that you're perceiving through your sense organs, which is creating a thought modification in your mind. All of it's in your awareness. Is your awareness being modified by the room? If it was, what would happen to the awareness then? Right? The awareness, in fact, is the constant because of which everything is known. It's the knownness which is the constant. Now let's add some dimensions. Say not only through your sense organs everything is known and nothing is away from that knownness. Now throw in a few emotions. Everything is known and there are also emotions in the mind. So now the emotions are also pervaded by awareness. There's nothing that's not pervaded by awareness, by you. Right? Are you changing? The emotions are changing, the perceptions are changing, everything is changing, but they're changing in awareness. They're not changing awareness, they're changing in awareness. Right? And so the awareness, your being, remains nirvikalpa. And that is what has to be recognized. You're not becoming nirvikalpa, right? You're not having to go somewhere to have an experience of nirvikalpa. You have to recognize that you are nirvikalpa, right? That you are changeless, you are without division. So there's nowhere for you to go. But then the mind, it's hard for the mind to believe that. You know, that we used to think sometimes Swamiji would say things and we would think, you know, oh, he's just saying that, trying to make us feel better. Well, but kind of with the idea that his mind, you know, is so evolved and so mature and everything, that it is like that for him. You know? That kind of thing. All kinds of rationalizations like that. And you know what the thing is, though, is that isn't true. Mm-hmm. It isn't true. It's not because his mind or the teacher's mind is so evolved and so clear, you know, that she recognizes, say, I really recognize that. Well, there's something really special about me. And that's why. Yeah. And you poor thing sitting there, you have to, you know, evolve.
Keep coming.
You know what? It is not true. It is not true. It is not true. And that excuse has to be eradicated. You know, if it were true, then there are steps to be taken, right? There's kind of a path. You mature in this way and come to this level, and then you mature and we can say, well, you know, this is, you're doing fine. You're on this level now. And after a while, you know, things will happen and mature and your mind will change and you will become closer to the Atma, and then you will be on this level. And, you know, and then you will evolve a little farther and you'll be on this level. This is not true. You know? The self that you are is totally 100% present right now, with a happy mind or with a sad mind. And so this is what has to be recognized, that yourself is wholly, completely present. You have to recognize that self. There are things we can do to help with that recognition, because the mind can be so active or have, you know, emotional hurts and whatnot that get in the way, you know, So there's a lot of techniques we can do to help calm the mind down, to just give it a chance to relax and recognize, so you can say, yes, I am here and I am aware of this active mind, or I am aware of this. So we do things to make the mind settle down a little bit, you know, just to help us recognize the obvious. But even that can be misleading. What I just said can take you on a trip. It can, you know. It's not that it's not good to do japa and meditation and all of these things to make the mind quiet, to give you a chance to hear the truth of these words. Okay? But when you hear the truth of these words, what you recognize is that the you that is here right now has always been here, always will be, and is not covered in any way. It makes no difference what you're thinking or feeling or seeing or experiencing. The Atma is totally 100% experientially present. It's not that your thoughts are covering you like a paper bag or something. You know? And that, when what makes this such a wonder is that, I mean, it's the realization of it is so incredible. It's such a wonder because you're realizing they're talking about me. This is me. The Upanishads are talking about me. The me that I take myself to be right now, I had just mistaken myself for this body. But the me that I had taken to be this body, it's this very me that is Brahman. It is this very me that is the whole. That's the incredible wonder. And that's the tricky thing, is to recognize that the Upanishads are actually talking about the you that you take yourself to be right now. You see what I'm saying? The one who says, when you say, I am the body, it is that me. You recognize that me, that is the self of the body, the me of the body, the me of the mind, it is this me that is Ishvara. This me is Ishvara. This me is you. It's this me that is the subject and the object. And there's nothing more than that. So that Ashcharyavat. Now there's nothing more than that. There is no greater wonder than that. So this verse is speaking to that. First, from the first interpretation, is speaking of the Atma as a wonder. The second we'll do a little bit next week, but the second one is speaking of the one who sees as a wonder. That's also nice. Shankara actually does it in the second way. Swamiji did it in both ways. So he did the first way he did it was the way I just did it tonight. Shankara only does it in the second way. Saying, what a wonder. What a wonder is the one who sees this. What a wonder. The one who teaches it, speaks of it. What a wonder the one who hears it. And what a wonder that you can hear it and not understand. Because it's so simple. This is beautiful. First, that they would even have a verse like this. It's incredible. It's amazing that they would have a verse like that. So, let's just take a minute.
Purnamidam Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
May chant the Purnamidam at the ashram. They don't any longer take that pause, so I'm not either.
You know. Yeah, you've speeded it up.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm telling you.
I like to pause in there.
Yeah, I know. But then I don't want you to go there, and if that's the way they're doing it, you know, traditionally. We used to take a pause like that.
But if you take a pause, then you can't catch up, because you're already down the line.
I know. That's why I'm leaving you. I'm leaving you all behind. I'm going to tell you what's going on. So change the way we chant it a little bit.
It just shoots the whole thing out.
You keep us on our toes.
Yeah.
It's neat that they, like you said, it's neat that they have a verse like that. Mm-hmm. This one.
I believe that verse is in the Katha Upanishad also. Yeah, right? I don't know if I've seen it elsewhere, but those two places. And it's true. The verse should be there, because that's how students feel. When you get knowledge, that's how you feel. There's another some verses in the Panchadashi, Danyoham.
Yeah.
You know, Swami Vagishananda will chant those verses. I'm so blessed. Yeah, it feels like goes through all the different ways I'm blessed by this knowledge. But it's nice to have that because the student feels that way. It's a relief to get knowledge.
Well, it's extraordinary.
Sure beats the alternative.
Swamiji said once, he said it's worth anything to gain it.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a... I mean, when you think of what that ignorance does to a person, you are actually the whole. That's who you are. And then with the self-ignorance, you take yourself to be, you know, just a finite creature subject to death, seeking happiness and well-being in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the antithesis of who you are. And so it's not going to work. How can you feel happy with that? Because it's not you. You're taking yourself to be the opposite of what you are, actually. And so nothing jives. Yeah. And there's some unfoldments, like when you unfold the meaning of Sat Chit Ananda. You know, Sat means existence. And you are Sat. Your existence means existence that doesn't come to an end, timeless. Existence which is not subject to change. And so what does an Ajnani do? Always seeking to exist one more minute, one more day. You can do it in the Shastra. There'll be kind of jokes about that. You know, I'm not afraid of death. Well, okay, go ahead then. No. No, not right now. Tomorrow.
A little bit later.
I'm not afraid of it, but no, not right now. You know, let me just go on. I'll push my existence to the limit, you know. And then with chit, consciousness, knowledge, you know. We always want to know more. You know? We always seek to know, to accumulate, to know. There's tremendous curiosity. We want to complete ourselves. We want to know, you know. We want to know because, you know, to fulfill yourself with knowledge, which is a very difficult thing, because it's impossible. So, in fact, they even say that a pundit, somebody who is a scholar, becomes the most humble person. Because the more you know that you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So this, in that search for knowledge, you become smaller and smaller and smaller. Because as your beam of light grows, the circumference of darkness is that's being illumined grows, right? So you become more and more and more aware of all that you don't know. And so there's actually no fulfillment in terms of knowledge until you recognize that you are the knowledge. You are the knowledge that illumines all of these objects. You are the known. Atma is the known. You're trying to collect known things so that you can get to finally get enough knowns to, you know. But what you have to recognize is that the chit, the consciousness itself, is the known. That's the fulfillment. And then the ananda. We don't know. We don't know I am ananda. I am the ananda. So what do we spend our whole life doing is seeking it. We're all spend our everything that we do is seeking for ourself. You know? I want myself. I want myself. I want to find myself. I want to find myself. And we don't say it exactly in those words, you know. But it's, you know, I want to be whole. I want to be complete. I want to fulfill myself. Because I am whole. I am complete. I am full. Right? So it's like saying, I want to get myself back. What's the matter with me? This isn't how I'm supposed to be. I'm supposed to be a whole, complete, full being. Let me have this, and let me have this, and let me have this, so that I can become that. Yeah. So we're seeking ourselves very uncontentedly. You know? Even the saints that weren't jnanis, you know, you can be a very saintly person. There's a tremendous longing in the lives of the saints, not people with self-knowledge, but in the lives of the saints, there's tremendous longing for completion, usually in the sense of union with God. Because that you would think of those words, right, union with God, as a finality, like a completion of the journey. Yeah. But as long as you are seeking union with God, there's a barrier between you and God, right? Because you have to have union with God. That means you haven't recognized at that time, I am the whole. And until you do, you'll be seeking yourself. It's amazing.
In some ways, this story also seems, I mean, the package that this teaching comes into, the Gita, Arjuna is so, basically he loves his teacher, he loves his family, he loves all these people, there's such attachment. And like, I've been to funerals in India, and I've never seen such. And I've been around Indians, they have such attachment for each other, more than I'd say anybody in my family has for each other.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's ironic.
That attachment is held by a much deeper culture and religious, spiritual understanding. But it's true that Indian heart is something extraordinary love and gratitude and familial attachment. That's a little something. And they know how to grieve also.
What?
They know how to grieve. You know, like if they lose a family member, that they have rituals and a way of being with grief and with loss that is really beautiful.
So it's really not ironic. It's actually real.
Real. It's really like, human.
Exactly. It's beautiful. You know.
So when you talk about it's the me that I think myself to be right now.
Right. Minus. Minus the upadis.
That's kind of my question then. When someone has, you know, understood like you had understood.
Yeah.
And there's no identification with the body and the mind. Is your experience of me the same as my experience of me being still identified with the body?
It is. It is.
So there's no.
What was that?
You say minus.
What I mean, well, let me say what I mean there by the minus. When you say, If you sit here and you say, right now, I am the body. That's like the pot saying, I am the clay. Okay? Now, the pot is the clay. It's true. Isn't it? The pot is the clay. Well, if I say, my mind says, I am the body, right? It's like, I keep the body and mind kind of together there. So the body is saying, I am the body. What it's doing there is taking the I am, the self, the conscious being, right, and saying this conscious being, right, is this body. So that means if this body dies, the conscious being will die, right? That's the mistake. But what isn't a mistake is that the sense of me that you identify with this body, that when you say I am, so that there's a sense of self, this person here, that this person, you say this person is this body. That this person part, the me, that is now identified with this body, it is that me that is Brahman. And not that it's not this body, but it's more than this body. In other words, if this body falls, that me is still there. That's what we don't know. Right? And so, the me that you identify with, your sense of self, that now has the body superimposed on it, the mind superimposed on it, that sense of self that you have, that is Brahman. There's no other sense of self. So like when you, so now when we all say I am, we're all referring to our sense of self, right? Well, that sense of self is Brahman. So now a good meditation, an open eye meditation, close your eyes for it, is if you just, as you're sitting here, what essentially makes you you? Not the thoughts that come and go, because they go, but there's someone having those thoughts. There's somebody having this body. Me, your own presence. Right? What is that that's most, the most beloved, that is most you? Your own core me-ness. Right? And one good way to get to that, that when you say, I am the body, then you're not trying to separate the body out and, you know, get a me out here and a body out here. Just the I, that when you say, I am the body, that I, that self. Now, if you can kind of recognize that, then the thing to try is try to make it change. Try to get rid of it in any way, or to change it. Try to look at your different thoughts, or even meditate and try to get rid of it. What can't you get rid of? What is the self-experience that no matter what you do, you can't get rid of? That's a good thing for even if there's a depressed thought or an agitated thought. What is still there that has not gone? That hasn't changed? What's still there? That's why depression is great for that. You know, or agitation or anger or any of these things. It'll help you to see who's still there. The anandavritti, you know, the happy mind, that type of thought, or the peaceful mind, that's not there. The bliss is not there. Joy is not there. But you are there. Completely. And then that thought goes and another, that emotion goes, another one comes. That same you is there. Always. Thus you have to walk around and say, okay, what about me is never, ever, ever changing, no matter what.
So it's still, for you, it still feels completely personal?
Yeah, it is completely personal. It is completely personal. It will never not be personal. Because that's who you are. You would never feel, just imagine, okay, you say, I am the body, that I am this body-mind complex. I say that. This I is completely personal. The one, no matter what the thoughts are coming and going, identification with the body, sometimes there, sometimes not. Like if you're reading a book or talking to a friend, listening to music, you're not always even conscious of your body. But you are there, and there couldn't be anything more personal than you. Right? And that personal you is Brahman.
Just the recognition that I am the whole, is that a similar kind of recognition of I am the self? What I mean by that, is that a kind of an instantaneous recognition? Oh, I am the whole. Is it like that? And then you just say, oh, I've always been the whole. That's always been true.
Well, I think in the recognition of... okay. The recognition of the changelessness of yourself is when you see it, you see it. But then doubts can come in terms of the nature of the creation and all of that, the maya, the mitya, the creation. All of these things are going to be doubts. But in reference to yourself, you don't have a right side or a left side or a top or a bottom. You're not two ways. You are just what you are. And there's no parts to you. So when you recognize that, that recognition is whole and complete. And you can't, it's not going to change. Right? But now, in the recognition of this body, mind, sense organs being part of the universe and the universe itself not being separate from you, you being the very substance of this, that takes clarity. A lot of understanding about the nature of the creation and how that is so, and recognizing with different logics, understanding certain logically that these things that you think are substances aren't, that there are no substances, that you are the only substance. And as you understand the nature of this creation, the mityatva of it, through logic and teaching and understanding, then there's no sense of, how to say it? You logically understand that there's nothing here but consciousness, and that understanding backs your experience. In other words, it's not away from the experience, but we have to be careful because the experience of consciousness is not an object. You don't look at the consciousness. You are the consciousness, right? Then as you understand that this empirical world that you're experiencing has no substance, it's all infinitely divisible, it all comes from non-existence, goes into non-existence, and the only common denominator that the whole thing has is you, your being. But that you understand through teaching that that's true on an empirical level as well as on the level of your vritti, thought modification, which is much easier to understand. Like you can, it's easy to see in a thought that the entire thought, the truth of the entire thought is consciousness existence. Right? And that conscious existence is invariable. So to have a recognition of that experience, a nishta, clarity in the experiential truth that the thought, none of it is away from you, that you are the being of it, that there's an experiential reality there. Everybody with me on that? And so the mind can see that whole thing, that I am the self of that. Right? So now the problem is, yeah, I'm the self of the thought, but that doesn't prove that I am the self of the world. Okay? So now, this is the situation. It is a fact that in whatever I experience as a human being, I experience through my thought. All perceptions, everything, come, any type of dual experience, right, is experienced through the thought. And so my only experience really is of my being pervading the whole thing. Once it's pointed out, in terms of my mind, that's a reality. And I'll never be away from that, no matter where I look or what I still pervade the totality of it, because all I experience is my mind. Okay? But now you have to recognize that it's not just your mind that is pervaded by awareness. This is all awareness, only awareness also. How are you going to know that? By analyzing the nature of this reality that you experience through your sense organs. So now we don't care that really we're only experiencing the vritti, versus the thought modification. We're saying, okay, this object out here that we are experiencing through the mind, that has its own reality. Does it? And we have to prove that. You say, okay, you say this is real. This is a real object. This is matter. It's matter. You know? Show me some. Show me an object. You show me one object. Find one for me. You find an object for me. And then you can't find one. All you can find in the creation are conglomerates. So then we go through that whole logic. And you have to make your mind go through that. Anything that you call an object is divisible. And so actually it wasn't an object. It was a name. It was a name for conglomerate. So we take the universe apart in that way. Then there's other, so that's one whole thing. You have to see that. You have to do that and see it. So that dismisses, that logic dismisses that there is a substance. You can't find a substance. The only substance, in fact, that is there is the very existence that all these things enjoy. That is the substance. So you start seeing that, that experience that I have, that is, in fact, the reality. That being, which is not the only thing that's non-objectifiable, not divisible, it is that being that is the substance. Existence itself is the substance. Then you look again at this world that we experience as something that is bound by change. And everything in the universe is bound by change. It comes into being, it goes out of being. Right? That's also a fact. Anything that changes comes into being and goes out of being. Right? It had a prior condition. It changes, now it's this condition. It changes again, now that's gone. Okay? If you understand that and look at that moment of change, that moment, that object is bordered by non-existence. Right? Because it wasn't before. Before that change, that object wasn't. Well, you can say, well, yes, it was. No, it wasn't. What was the substance of the object. Right? What was the, and that subject, that substance was there. But then we have to go in and say, well, what was the substance then? You know? And then what we find is that substance itself, when we start searching for to find the substance that, you know, that doesn't come out of it, come from non-existence and go into non-existence. We have to find that substance. That substance has to be changeless, because otherwise it would come from non-existence and go into non-existence. It has to be changeless. There's nothing in the creation that's changeless, except existence itself. And so these many, many teachings, even the teaching in terms of cause-effect relationship, all of these things, we have to do them thoroughly in order for you to believe your experience. It's not, you have the experience because consciousness, the conscious being that you are, is the non-objectifiable common denominator of all experience. Okay? And so you can't get away from that. But now you have to believe that this is the common denominator of the universe, not just of your mind. Okay? So that takes a lot of teaching. And there's just, we go at it from many, many different ways. Like, for instance, again, just the recognition with the seer seeing differentiation. What is so powerful about that? Well, it makes, just like you are all an object, it makes this body, mind, sense organ, an object in the universe.
Can I
this stuff in this moment, you said you have to believe it. So,
believe it means see it, understand it.
Right, but I mean, in terms of like, this is, I guess what I'm still trying to get to, it's like, self-knowledge is really recognition of your actual experience, of what you're, what,
yeah,
it really is.
Yeah.
And so, it seems to me like what you're saying, and it could be wrong, is that you can see this in terms of your mind, that is completely pervaded by yourself.
Yeah.
But that in terms of objects, like, that you just have to just totally accept those logics, see that that there's no other way it can be, but you will really only know this in terms of your mind, in a sense, in terms of, you know, in terms of the vritti, in terms of yourself pervading the vritti.
It's a little bit more than that, but there's a yes and no to that. The yes to that is that, in fact, in this creation, from the standpoint of the jiva, the only actual experience you're going to have is the experience of, first of all, the self-evident nature of your own being, and then whatever is given through the mind and sense organs. That's the extent of your experience. But with that experience, because I experience myself as an individual in this creation, and I see you experiencing me, etc., right? We can, through the use of the teaching methodology and just the simple use of perception and of inference, there are certain facts. Like one is that just like all of you are sitting in this room, so am I. That's a fact, right? Just like all of you are objects of my awareness, so is this body. That is a fact. And it's an indisputable fact. And so it's by collecting clearly these indisputable facts that you then understand that the experience that you're having is the truth. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's kind of like this would be like a way of an extension that we can do. Here, I realize that you are all objects of my awareness. Okay. Now, if you're an object of my awareness, I can trust that the whole universe is an object of my awareness in potential, right? Because it's manifest. I may need a microscope or a telescope, or I may need to travel, but it's objectifiable, right? So I'm not going to say, you know, I know all of you are an object of my awareness, but I don't know what would happen if I go outside. Would those things outside also be objects of my awareness? Right? I'm not going to say that. Because my mind, through the use of inference, trusts, you know, that I can extend that. Right? And so, because of that, also, when I understand what's going on in this room, in the immediacy of my own experience, I can extend it. It's the same. But in terms of consciousness, my consciousness, the conscious being, is not objectifiable. It's not possible to have a subject-object relationship between consciousness, because then who's conscious of that consciousness? So that is true for me. But it's also true for you, right? I can't objectify my consciousness. There's no subject-object. It's not an object. So look, this is, if I say, okay, the conscious being that I am is not an object of awareness. Not an object. It's not an object of my awareness. Right? It doesn't exist within time and space as an object. Right? So if you can say that. But now you can say that too. And you can say that. And you can say that. None of us are objects within the creation. None of us are objectifiable. Space is objectifiable. Time is objectifiable. The physical bodies are objectifiable. The sense organs are objectifiable. The minds are objectifiable. Consciousness is not objectifiable. What is dividing us? You know?
Well, like that, I can't objectify another person's consciousness, you know?
Yeah, no, you can't. Consciousness.
But you're conscious.
They can't do it either. You can only be it. And now, all of the things that are objectifiable are mitya. That's another thing. Everything that is objectifiable, including your body, your mind, your sense organs, all of them are infinitely divisible. Right? And all of them come into existence and go out of existence. So they don't have any being of their own. Your body and my body are the same boat. They're all mitya, you know. But can you say that the consciousness is mitya? No, because it's not an object. It doesn't come into being. It doesn't go out of being. It doesn't have a form. It's not subject to time. So these understandings, as they pile up, your mind, your ego finally gives up, says, okay.
I'm convinced.
All right. But you have to understand it all. It's really important. It's important to your mind has to see it and understand it. You know? It's recognition and understanding. It's not just you recognize something and then you don't understand it. You know, you should, your mind should be able to freely associate and think about it, and you know, has to make sense. And the mind is like that. It doesn't like to not understand. And it keeps knocking at the door until it becomes clear. Vedanta's like that too. It doesn't mind you knocking at the door. It'll say, oh yes, that's a good question. And then you come up with a whole bunch of other things. Yes. That's it.
Yeah, we'll talk about it.
Yeah. It expects those questions. Because you have a mind. The mind wants to know. It wants to understand. Why shouldn't it? Why shouldn't it understand? Yeah. All right, we better stop.